And again, the story is probably fairly well known if you've been around church circles for a while. But there are a couple of features there that tend to get missed, or I think are worth talking about as we try to approach it. And the first will only be noticed if you are just obsessively detail-oriented, like a hardcore engineer type. And that detail would be, if you look in the bulletin, the fourth verse is missing. Now, that's not a misprint. As it turns out, when the chapters and verses were being added to the Bible, which is pretty recent, like in the last several hundred years, you know, that's recent for the church anyway. At that time, the copies of the New Testament manuscripts that we had had that verse in it, which makes sense. Since that time, we have found literally, I wasn't involved, but scholars have found literally thousands of copies of the New Testament in fragments and larger pieces. And some of these are far older and therefore much better and closer to the original manuscripts of the New Testament. And they don't include that verse. And so logically, or at least the reasoning goes, that it is far more likely that a scribe, somebody copying by hand the book of John, maybe wrote in the margin, maybe 100, 200 or so years, maybe a little more, an explanation for why the waters get stirred, which happens a few verses later, because that is totally in the book of John. And he just wrote that, well, there's a legend there's an angel that would stir them, and so on and so forth. And then at some point, I don't know, some scribe is writing it, maybe it's late or he's not paying attention and ends up seeing that margin note and just putting it in there or something, and then that gets copied. That's how that works. But it's very interesting that legend or that explanation of why the waters get stirred endured for a while. Now, does that mean it was actually happening? I don't know. I'm going to leave that up to you to figure out. But I will say that when the Romans conquered the city of Jerusalem, one of the times, they conquered Jerusalem several, the pool of Bethesda maintained or retained that reputation of being a place of healing. And we know this because they found like a carving or inscription of what's called the Rod of Asclepius on it. And that's like, you know, if you see like at a doctor's office, like the symbol of like that serpent going up that rod, that goes way back to ancient Greek times, but it's associated with healing, and then eventually modern medicine has taken it and used it. So it still had that reputation. Now, is that a worldview thing? Was this truly like a very, very special place where healing did happen? Again, I don't know. I will leave that up to you. I'm far more interested in the interaction that Jesus has. Because, and this is not the only time where Jesus does this, he goes up to somebody who has an obvious need and then says, what do you want? What do you think? like famously, a guy named Bartimaeus on the outskirts of the city of Jericho, he comes up to Jesus and Jesus says, what do you want me to do for you? Like, what do you think he wants? He's blind, and you have a reputation of healing. But as you might imagine, when Jesus asks these questions, which are frankly quite obvious, the question isn't the question. The question is meant to go deeper. And so in this case, this man has been laying there on a mat, hoping to get to the water when it's stirred up. Again, how that works or what's going on, I don't know. But Jesus says, do you want to be healed? Yes. I mean, why answer that? What is he really asking? He's asking, how are you going to get there? And actually, and I didn't pay Lindsay or let her know ahead of time to tee this up during the children's message. But she was absolutely right. This is a guy without options. He doesn't have any hope because he doesn't have anybody with him to take him the rest of the way. And not only that, he's been there for 38 years. How would you be if you were, you know, kind of close to a place that potentially could make you able to walk, and yet you have been unable to for 38 years? That's bleak. That's terrible. And as he says, he's got no one to take him, and yet he's still there. Like, this is an image of a guy who has no real options and probably not a lot of hope. And so my first question for you is, how do you do when you are stuck? Like, something has gone wrong. You are in some way gridlocked. You don't have any options. You don't have any hope. And you're just there. See, human beings, just generally speaking, can endure a lot if they have a sense of hope. Like, you can endure anything if you truly believe that things could get better. And, or, there's a sense of meaning or purpose behind that suffering. Like, either of those, or especially those combined, human beings, we have a long history of people enduring crazy amounts of just suffering and struggle because there was hope and because there had meaning. I would argue that this is an image of a guy who has neither of those things. He's just stuck. And so, where have you found yourself in life just stuck? Maybe like in a relationship, like you hit gridlock, and neither is really wrong, but neither can like give any ground. So you're just stuck. Or you're trying to work through solutions to a problem, like life, and just nothing's coming up, but it's got to be fixed, and it just can't. Or you've talked to a doctor, and there's nothing they can do for you. And that could mean, like, the big bad, or it could just mean, yeah, you're going to be sick, you're going to be miserable, you're going to hurt. We can't fix it. You're just stuck. That is where this guy is. He's got nobody, he's got no options. What do you do? Now, there's multiple levels, multiple layers of things happening, which is kind of John's style of writing. It's just a thing he does. Because Jesus ends up, as Lindsay said, it's like she just took the words. Jesus ends up being this guy's hope. And I would bet all that I have that John, as he is writing this, very specifically wants that point to come across. That Jesus is somebody's hope when there is no other hope. Now, we've been making, this is going to sound trite, but we've been making a big deal about Easter. Because it is a big deal. It is the biggest deal. We're still in the weeks that kind of reverberate out from Resurrection Sunday. And one of the many reasons why it is such a big deal is that Jesus in his death and resurrection draws everything, all people and all of their stories onto himself. And in his brutal public murder, state-sponsored murder, he defeats death when he walks out of that tomb 3 days later. And because of that, What has happened is that he has created, he has demonstrated his ability to redeem anything, any and all suffering. Like, that's the point of his death, or one of multiple points of his death. And so, in that sense, he really is like that one hope that can't be taken away. Jesus will not leave you, even when you're stuck. The late, great Reverend Dr. Tim Keller would say it like this: do not confuse God's silence with God's absence. And I'll say that again: don't confuse God's silence with his absence. Because just because God has been quiet doesn't mean he's not there. It doesn't mean he doesn't care. We look at Easter and we see the fact that God can and will redeem everything. That even if we don't understand it here and now, the story that God is telling in your life, even in that moment when you are stuck, is a story of redemption. Now, that may not be apparent now. It may not be apparent up and including day five, but there will come a time in the resurrection and renewal of all things that is finishing on Easter. You look back and say, oh, that's the story God is telling. All things, including being just absolutely stuck and without hope, can be redeemed. Now, there's more than to this story. And this story is just the beginning of a much longer story. Because John tees it up with that last line at the end when he says, now it was a Sabbath. Shabbat, the day of rest. If you are an observant Jewish person, both the first century and depending on kind of denomination, is a day where his mat. That's considered work. It's considered forbidden or breaking the laws of the Sabbath. And it seems like it. And what's going to happen after that is this guy is going to pick up his mat and he's going to walk for the first time in, I guess, 38 years, which would be amazing. And that connection back to what we just said, I think that guy is going to tell the story of why he can walk. Is he just going to say, yeah, I couldn't walk and now I can, it's pretty neat? I don't. Instead, he's going to tell a story of redemption. I laid there for 38 years with no options, and this man healed me. That's a redemption story. That's so much better than, yeah, I couldn't walk and now I can. Because a redemption story takes the pain and the suffering and the struggle and the stuckness and turns it into something else. But anyway, he's walking with this mat, which he shouldn't be carrying, and some religious authorities say, do that. Why are you doing that? And he says, well, the person that healed me, which first off should be a little bit of a red flag. I mean, these religious leaders should have the whereabouts to say, if someone can do something like that, I feel like he's allowed to say, yeah, go ahead and break that rule. That's just fine. It seems to lend credibility to him. But interestingly enough, the guy doesn't know who Jesus is. So they then say, instead of, wow, somebody did that, instead they say, who was that? And the guy goes, I don't know. So eventually, over the course of, it's a whole thing, you can go read it in chapter 5, but they'll figure out that it's Jesus, and they'll start an argument, really a fight, about authority and who Jesus really is in relation to God the Father, and it just kind of goes from there. They'll actually have some questions about Jesus, his lineage, his parentage, like who his father actually is, which suggests that they think, like, hey, I heard that Joseph isn't your real father, which, correct. It's not who you think it is, though. But anyway, what I find really interesting about this, and potentially very helpful, is that the religious leaders couldn't see past a rule that they set. It was them. It is not said in the Bible that you can't carry them. Can't see past that and understand that God has just worked and done something amazing. Now, this has all kinds of implications, and it's actually really, really, like, prescient or important to us today. Like, we're a group of human beings, as best I can tell. And any group, institution, organization, whether it's a family, a church, a club, corporation, anything, has a tendency to develop rules and ways of doing things that aren't necessarily spoken. Like, they're not written down, they're not codified. It's just things that we do and don't do. Like, for example, hypothetically, imagine like a new couple. They get married, they move in together, and one in that couple, they see the trash sort of getting high to the top, so you just take the bag, tie it off, and take it out. And another in that couple, which is totally not me, sees this as a challenge. See how much trash I can fit into that before I have to take it out. And that's a game I don't lose at, by the way. I'm very, very good at it. These are unspoken rules. They're just things that we do. You probably weren't taught them, necessarily. Especially the, see how much you can fit in it. But at some point, that rule's going to get broken for one or the other. And you got to figure it out. And that's kind of a silly example, but anytime you get people together, we will have these unspoken rules, these ways that we think that probably fine. I mean, if it wasn't fine and it was just breaking things around us, then we would probably fix it or name it and say, yeah, we shouldn't do that. But most of the time, things just kind of go along until someone breaks an unspoken rule, and then now we got to deal with that. That's what's happening in that moment. And what the religious leaders can't see is that God is working. And so this presents a challenge for us as a church community. What unspoken rules, what unnamed things, what ways of being, or what have we always just done that might stand in the way of what God is doing? Because God is really active. He's really doing things. There are some very exciting things happening. And the last thing I would want is for us, and I'm very much including myself in this, to say, well, that breaks these things. Wait, are they rules? No, they're not. I don't know what to do here. In other words, the last thing I would want to do is get in the way of what God is doing. And so I'll conclude with these two points reiterated, because they're both so important. Is that the story of a man laying there for 38 years stuck without hope until Jesus is his hope is just a glimpse at how God, through Jesus, can make your story a story of redemption. And this can either be now or in the future. And like, if you are feeling completely stuck right now, I hope and pray that it helps to know that even if you can't see it, God will redeem that. Or if you find that things are going fine right now and you've got no way that you're just stuck in the middle of it or struggling or suffering and you don't know how to make sense of it, if that does not apply to you, then I would encourage you to look back and think about a time when you were. Because as best I can tell, you are still here, which means God, or hopefully God, has redeemed that in some way. And then secondly, as an organization where God is at work, what unspoken rules put in place? We encounter that uncomfortableness where God is actively doing things. What do we need to do to not trip over our own feet or not get in the way of what the Holy Spirit does? That second is a much larger question. But I pray we understand that second part in light of the first. Why wouldn't we want to bring and be a part of God's redemption of the world and ourselves to everybody?